This program was produced at and first aired on MPR, Manawatu People's Radio, with support from New Zealand On Air. Ka pai, irirangi tamotu, MPR. Support this show and others like it by giving a donation. For more information, go to www.mpr.nz/donate.
Welcome to Manawatu Conversations, recollections of the past and sometimes opinions about the future. Today we have with us
Kevin Lowe.
Alice Milden.
And I'm Stuart Burks. Now, Kevin, we've been talking about PEC and there were, among other things with petrol pumps, there were various other products that they developed.
Yes, in the mid-1980s, the use of cards became prevalent. Initially as credit cards produced by American Express and Diners Club, and then a little bit later on as ATM cards, which were issued by the banks to their customers with check accounts to withdraw money from an ATM. A hole in the wall that typically in those days was in the wall of the bank.
Yeah, and ATMs are an automatic teller machine.
Yes. For we watched the growth of that market and had an idea that we could marry a petrol pump and the technology we had already in the petrol pump, which was electronic and could transmit the information required, marry that technology with cards, and particularly focusing on the ATM cards. So we started discussions with various banks to be able to read the bank's ATM card at a point of sale, and that was not being done anywhere else in the world to our understanding, although there were people talking about it. We had an awful lot of work to do to retain the security and safety around the transaction, because we were dealing with moving money around at that point. But we successfully developed a range of products that were initially placed in service stations where you could pay for your petrol with your ATM card. And that in fact was the genesis of FPOS, because prior to that these cards had only been able to be used in the outside wall of the bank.
Yeah, so FPOS is the electronic fund transfer at the point of sale. So
yes.
Instead of giving cash out, it's doing a transfer into a designated account.
You're buying a good or a service for that, yes.
Yeah.
Rather than money. So we worked for quite a long time, a couple of years, I guess, with banks in developing the protocols and understanding, putting all the safeguards in place. And then we launched a series of products, as I say, with card readers on the pumps themselves, card readers on the forecourts in some cases, and card readers inside service stations. And they were the very first FPOS transactions in New Zealand.
About when did this first begin?
That's kind of difficult. I would say it was in the late 80s, I think. 87, 88, somewhere around there. The success of that product and the fact that virtually all service stations started using it helped to make the uptake of FPOS or card operation at the point of sale very taken up very quickly in New Zealand, to the point that even today, New Zealand is a very, very high user of FPOS transactions in the world, and we use in New Zealand far less cash than most other countries.
Was there any resistance to people to using that at first?
Yes, indeed. Yeah, there was a whole lot of issues to be overcome, not the least of which was at the same time we were introducing self-serve, which means that people were allowed to use the fuel pumps themselves. And if you remember back to prior to that time, you were not allowed to pick up the nozzle of the petrol pump yourself. You had to wait for an assistant to come along, do it for you. So we had to deal with the safety, health and safety issues and the flammable goods issues of all that and transferring the responsibility to users.
So what did that involve? So automatic cut-offs?
Yes, automatic cut-offs, a whole lot of interlocks on the pumps and a whole lot of sensors to ensure that there were no spills, or if there were spills, that the equipment was shut off and the fuel was actually secured so that it wouldn't be a danger. As well as that, the FPOS transaction meant that the transaction for paying for the fuel, which included the individual's PIN number and included the individual's card details, were being transmitted through a public network, and they had to be adequately encrypted, and all care and attention had to be made to ensure that they couldn't be intercepted, that false equipment couldn't be placed that captured PIN numbers and the like. And so there was a whole lot of security issues around the PIN number of the card holder and the card number that had to be kept secure. But other than that, the uptake was very good by the public, and as I say, to the extent that it pushed the use of card transactions in New Zealand for a period at least way beyond that of any other country.
Was the phone system reliable enough for something like that?
Yes, it was reliable enough. It was really starting. The products had modems in them. They were transmitting the information over the public telephone network, the analog telephone network. It was a long time before the internet. There was a sufficient amount of telecommunications technology to cope.
And it meant it would operate fairly quickly. I'm thinking if you've got a rural service station, connection for the FPOS.
It perhaps took a little longer, but in fact, I don't think we were experiencing delays any more than you currently experience, really, in terms of authorising a transaction. Those products, and there was a sort of a suite of products in that area, were also exported to quite a number of countries.
So I suppose if you were doing it for the petrol stations and you had these machines in the pumps but also in the service station itself, and they were selling other products, that was basically the trigger for it to go into normal shops?
Yes, that's right. Everybody saw this happening, and that really generated a huge amount of interest, and a lot of other people, a lot of other companies started to develop products for.
Oh, so PEC didn't follow that through elsewhere?
Not into general retail, no.
No.
PEC stuck to their little fuel system.
Yeah.
That was quite big enough for us.
Yeah.
And we were far better off specialising in that little niche and exporting the products.
Yeah.
To other countries.
So what would these other companies have taken some of the technology and the license from you to do?
Yes, they did. Yes, and initially those, time and technology moved on, but initially, the company licensed some of the technology to other companies.
Okay. So how you say it's moved on? So how in shops would it be different from?
The technology itself hasn't moved on. The technology in use when you buy a loaf of bread at your local dairy is really no different from the technology that we developed. Well, yeah, the technology or the protocols that we developed when we did the first one in the 80s. It's not a lot different at all.
Yeah. Okay. And were there any other sort of experimental areas that you worked on at PEC? Trying out some different ideas, maybe some which didn't follow through?
The success of FPOS, I think, is still my enduring memory of PEC's greatest achievement, but we did move into a new area of security systems based on the fact that we knew an awful lot about cards by that stage. They were largely magnetic stripe cards, but sometimes they had embedded chip cards in them as well. We realised we knew an awful lot about that, and we realised that there was a wide opening in the area of security systems, in particular access control systems for opening doors, opening gates, which had been done largely by the sort of mechanical keyboards that you still see around.
The
pin number type keyboard. Yes. Mm. So the world was sort of crying out for a system that kept records, that you were able to shut people out when you didn't like them anymore, and if they were employees and they left, you could stop them coming back into the premises. Lots of issues like that were becoming important. So our access control systems got to be very successful as a business tool. A lot of companies took them up locally. Massey University had Cardex. Was the name of the product, Cardex products through it, but so did lots of very prestigious places overseas, like London Underground, right throughout their network was controlled by a system produced in London.
You did the London Underground?
Yes.
Yeah, I remember at Massey, I think we went through various stages, but there were cards to get into the buildings, and then it might allow you certain building, and then also for the parking, the different car parks and so on.
Yes.
That actually extended, so you could, for the car parking, you could add credit to your card, and then that's used as you do the parking and so on.
Yes, Yes.
So loading money onto a card that you can use.
Yes, well, it wasn't loaded onto the card physically.
Yes.
The card was a passive device. Yeah. It was loaded into your details in the central computer system.
Yes, that's right. Yeah.
So that became a whole range of products. I guess there was probably 20 or 30 different products of various types. Access control systems that were card only. They had card plus PIN. There were ones for gates. There were a whole range, probably 20 or 30 different products over the period.
Did you move to the sort of remote access type of things? You know, press a button and the doors open and so on.
No, that was essentially left to the installer. We really only produced the system that validated whether you were allowed to walk through a door.
Okay. Yeah.
We didn't get into the sort of door hardware, I suppose. And so that again became a very successful product, to the extent that it was eventually that division was purchased by Gallagher Engineering Company of Hamilton, and they have continued to develop it into a very large business.
So what was do you recall the motivation for that in the first part? You said there was the technology there, but was it that there was the problem of keys and so on, so is there something better, or giving individual control?
No, it was really the fact that we were getting very expert at dealing with cards through our banking and FPOS success, we saw the opportunity for cards to be used, we saw that nobody was doing it. So
did you have a sort of team of people brainstorming possibilities?
Yeah, we did, and we collaborated with other companies. There was a company, another company that was on the edge of mechanical door locks, non-key type door locks, and we collaborated with them. So we started to understand what their customers were wanting and work with them. That relationship didn't particularly go very far, but we learned an awful lot about that business through that collaboration.
Yeah. And what about within the country? You said you travelled overseas and so on, but is there a sort of an association of people with this sort of development, or
it's associations tend to follow along afterwards, and when the products are very new and being developed, there is very little in the way of industry associations that you can go to conferences and expos and things like that are allied to the business that you're trying to move into, but you tend to be a little bit ahead of the wave, and so you are largely on your own.
And what about sort of security and industrial espionage? Did you have to keep really quiet about your new ideas, or you were openly sharing them and getting feedback?
We were quite careful before we entered into relationships to have non-disclosure issues tidied up. And we seldom sought to publicise our expertise really until we had solid products in the marketplace.
So how would you go about the product development?
By that stage, we were getting quite good at product development, and we had a very methodical process whereby things were put up in what we called single page position statements, really. And these were the concepts, the ideas coming through from all sorts of things. And we would put them into a reasonably formal layout.
So within the company, some people would have some ideas, they'd do a sort of one-page proposal that would go forward, and there'd be a team of people looking through and say, do we take this further or drop this out?
Yeah, that's exactly the way it was. And the team was a little ad hoc. It was made up of some of the management team and some of the sales team and some of the factory workers actually were involved.
Yeah.
We tried to get a pretty cross-sectional group of people to actually discuss these, and it was a reasonably democratic voting system.
Yeah. So things like production feasibility and the costings and those and market research, was that formally done?
Eventually, as these ideas filtered to the top and started to get more resources put on them, they are the sort of resources that went on to them.
Yeah.
The business case, if you like, was being developed. Yeah. But this was way before the business case.
Yes.
This was just the spark.
Yeah. Okay. So now, and you said in our first recording, you said that they appointed something like 50. You virtually doubled the staff of the company with all these R&D people.
Yes.
Really. So that was a major part of the expense of the company, was it? The
yes, it was. Yeah.
So about what proportion of expenditure went into R&D, would you think?
In terms of it being a cost centre, I suppose at some stage it was between 30% and 40%. So it was very high. Apple, for example, talk about 35% of their turnover going into R&D.
Yeah. And pharmaceutical companies as well, to high proportion.
Higher than 60% they talk about.
Yeah.
So we were up about 35-40%.
Yeah. So and it's essentially a costly procedure, Aaron. The initial idea might be very cheap, but then all the later steps getting to a marketable product can be costly.
Yes, all our R&D people, and by the mid 90s, we had 200 people on R&D, which was probably one of the biggest R&D groups in the entire country.
Yeah. So when they talk about New Zealand and the number 8 wire mentality, do you think that fits, or it's totally off different from what you said?
No, I guess I'd have. I would like to put some process around number 8 wire. I don't believe too much in number 8 wire.
Yeah.
I think to do it consistently and to do it profitably. You actually need a lot of process.
Yeah.
And the process we had of letting the good ideas bubble up, if you like, through a formal group evaluation session, and then you fund the ones that get to the top, but still with a very tightly defined series of steps. So you allocate a certain amount of funds to see if this idea is going to fly, and that's where you bring in people that do surveys for you, market research people,
and the cost accountants.
All those guys that are going to tell you how much it's going to cost to do it properly, to the extent that. Virtually every product that was developed at PEC by the 1990s was costing probably $2 or $3 million before it returned any money at all. That was $2 or $3 million to market.
Yeah, but the company was big enough to
the company was big
enough. About how many things will be developed at the same time then?
Probably,
under development.
Probably max three or four.
Yeah.
Three or four big ones anyway.
So there's a lot of things just floating in the air and a few that you've followed through.
Yes.
To some extent.
Yeah. And then product development takes the traditional bathtub curve thing. It tends to be a little bit expensive to start and then gets very expensive towards the end. And so you time it all, I guess, to make sure that you do have the money available to take it to the finish line.
Yeah. Are there any pet products that you feel that you have ownership of yourself?
If there was, it would be the early days when there was a very small team because in the 80s and 90s there was so many people involved that it really was a team effort.
But a great culture, presumably.
Yeah, tremendous culture.
It was very supportive and not much competition to say.
No, it was a wonderful place. Mm-hmm. Everyone supported the development effort. Yeah. Everyone could see that it was working.
Were they all New Zealanders or you brought people from overseas?
No, we brought people from overseas. Yes, yeah. it was quite a mix-up.
Thank you for listening to Manawatu Conversations. This and other recent programs can also be found on the Manawatu People's Radio website, and a range of programs is also available on the Manawatu Heritage website of the Palmerston North City Archive. The address for that is manawatuheritage.pncc.govt.nz.
If you're a fan of NPR, listening to our podcasts and live stream has never been easier. Just search for accessmedia.nz on the App Store or Google Play and download the app with the kiwifruit logo. Once you've got it, pick Manawatu People's Radio from the list of stations and go find your new favourite show.